This content is AI-generated for informational purposes only and should not be directly used for clinical decision-making.
Hello and welcome back to the Neurosurgery Hub podcast. I'm Dr. Aris, a senior attending in neurosurgery.
And I'm Dr. Alara, a research fellow. Today, we're looking at a fascinating new study from Epilepsia Open, published in 2026, titled, Does Having Bad Epilepsy Make You a Good Surgical Candidate? A Number Needed to Treat Analysis.
This is a paper by Sally Baxendale and colleagues that really challenges some of the rhetoric we use in the epilepsy clinic. Specifically, it looks at that life-saving rationale we often invoke when we are considering surgery for patients who might not be the ideal candidates on paper.
Exactly. We know that for the right person, someone with mesial temporal sclerosis or a well-defined focal lesion, the outcomes are excellent. But what about the end-of-the-road patients, the ones with drug-resistant epilepsy who have failed everything, have high seizure burdens, and whose surgical odds aren't great? We often tell ourselves and the families that surgery is life-saving because of the mortality risks of uncontrolled epilepsy. This study asks, does the math actually support that?
It's a crucial question. Before we dive into the mortality data, let's set the stage with what we consider a good versus bad surgical candidate. Ilara, the paper provides a really nice summary in Table 1 regarding ILAE Class 1 outcomes.
Right. The strongest predictor of seizure freedom is a well-defined lesion on MRI. Think mesial temporal sclerosis, low-grade tumors like DNETs or gangliogliomas, or focal cortical dysplasia. In those lesional cases, we see seizure freedom rates around 70 to 80%, but that drops significantly to less than 50% in non-lesional cases.
And it's not just the MRI, it's the concordance. We want the EEG, the semiology, and the imaging to all point to the same spot. If they are discordant or multifocal, the prognosis for seizure freedom takes a hit. The authors also point out that extratemporal resections, especially in the frontal lobe, have much lower success rates, often between 30 and 50%.
And there is a temporal factor, too. Shorter duration of epilepsy, less than 10 years, and the absence of generalized tonic-clonic seizures, or GTCs, are associated with better outcomes. Ironically, as the paper notes, patients with frequent GTCs are at the highest risk for SUDEP, sudden unexpected death in epilepsy, but they are also the ones less likely to achieve postoperative seizure freedom.
That is the central paradox the authors are exploring. We use the risk of SUDEP to justify surgery in bad candidates, but if they don't achieve seizure freedom, are we actually reducing their risk? To answer this, Baxendale and the team used an NNT analysis, number needed to treat. For our residents listening, remind us how they calculated this.
They used absolute risk reduction, ARR, and NNT, derived from published mortality rates, deaths per 1,000 person years. They compared unoperated drug-resistant epilepsy patients against two postoperative groups, those who became seizure-free and those who did not. They then modeled this across different probabilities of seizure freedom and varying postoperative life expectancies.
Let's get into those numbers because they are quite sobering. If we assume a 50% probability of seizure freedom, which is a coin flip, really, what did the NNT look like for all-cause mortality?
At a 50% probability of seizure freedom, the NNT to prevent one all-cause death was 146 person years. For SUDEP specifically, it was even higher, 243 person years.
146 person years to save one life. That means if you follow 14.6 patients for 10 years, you might prevent one death. Now, what happens if the patient is a better candidate, say an 80% chance of seizure freedom?
The numbers improve, but perhaps not as much as you'd think. The NNT for all-cause death moves to 124 person years, and for SUDEP, it's 225. Conversely, in a poor candidate with only a 20% chance of success, the NNT for all-cause death worsens to 178 person years, and SUDEP climbs to 264.
This really highlights that the mortality benefit is almost entirely dependent on achieving that ILAE Class 1 or 2 status. The paper is very clear. Mortality reductions were greatest in those who became seizure-free, but remained modest in those who did not. In fact, they mention a terrifying possibility that surgery might actually increase mortality if generalized seizures continue after the operation.
That's a vital point for surgical counseling. If a patient is a poor candidate for seizure freedom, we can't necessarily use saving your life as a primary argument, because if the seizures persist, the risk profile might not shift in their favor at all.
However, the paper does offer a more optimistic view when we look at lifetime modeling. This is where the NNT becomes much more compelling for our younger patients.
Exactly. The NNT decreases sharply as the postoperative life expectancy increases. If a patient has 60 years of life ahead of them after surgery, the NNT drops to 3.5 for all-cause mortality and 4.7 for SUDEP.
That is a powerful statistic. An NNT of 3.5 over a lifetime is incredibly strong for a surgical intervention. It really reinforces the idea that we should be operating earlier in the disease course, especially in children and young adults, rather than waiting until they have exhausted every medication over 20 years.
It shifts the life-saving rationale from a last resort desperation move to a proactive early intervention strategy. The authors argue that the rationale for surgery in poor candidates is often framed by cognitive biases rather than this kind of hard data.
Let's talk about those biases. They mention action bias and optimism bias. As surgeons, we are particularly susceptible to action bias, aren't we?
Definitely. Action bias is the impulse to do something rather than do nothing, especially in high-stakes situations where a patient is suffering. We feel that by operating, we are at least trying to save them. But the study suggests that this we must do something thinking should yield to balanced, data-driven decision-making.
And then there's optimism bias, overestimating the likelihood of a positive outcome. We see a patient with a 20% chance of seizure freedom, and we focus on that 20% as a chance, rather than the 80% chance of failure. When we frame it as life-saving, we are often leaning heavily on that optimism.
The authors suggest that when surgery is considered primarily on mortality grounds, we need much more balanced risk-benefit discussions. We shouldn't invoke the life-saving tag if the probability of seizure freedom is low, because the data shows that those patients, the ones with the most severe bad epilepsy, are the least likely to realize a mortality benefit.
It's about being honest with the limitations of the procedure. If we aren't likely to stop the seizures, we aren't likely to stop the SUDEP risk.
One of the most striking conclusions for me was the long-term follow-up data they cited. Even in good candidates, 10 years after surgery, seizures are present in about 50% of patients. And for MRI-negative patients, only 20% are seizure-free at the 10-year mark.
It really puts the permanent cure narrative into perspective. We have to look at epilepsy surgery as a way to change the trajectory of the disease, but we must be realistic about the slope of that trajectory.
So, to summarize the paper's take on the original question, does having bad epilepsy make you a good surgical candidate? The answer seems to be not necessarily if your goal is mortality reduction. If the badness of the epilepsy, like multifocal zones or non-lesional pathology, makes seizure freedom unlikely, then the life-saving rationale is weak.
But if bad epilepsy means high-frequency seizures in a young person with a focal resectable lesion, then the lifetime NNT of 3.5 makes a massive case for surgery as a life-saving intervention.
It's all about the probability of the outcome. The mortality benefit is a secondary gain of the seizure freedom, not an independent result of the surgery itself.
This has been a great deep dive. For our residents, the take-home message is clear. Know your predictors of seizure freedom from Table 1. When you're in the clinic, use those to guide your mortality discussions. Don't let action bias cloud the fact that a patient who continues to have GTCs after surgery remains at high risk.
And remember that for the young patient with a clear lesion, surgery isn't just about quality of life. It's one of the most effective life-saving interventions we have in our neurosurgical toolkit.
Well said. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you for joining us on the Neurosurgery Hub podcast.
See you next time.